Hey guys. How's it going? Well, good. Me too. Today on the show, interviews with people. I need to write up a blog entry. I've been negligent this morning in writing up a blog entry. If you go to my website, scotthorton.org, you can read my blog entries there. scotthorton.org/stress. It's usually just today on the show. I need to get to blogging more, but I just keep saying that and keep not doing it. But anyway, here, see? Today, I do this too often, don't I? Today's show, James Bamford, and that's not how you say it, that's just how you spell it, but I have to think it that way or I'll spell it with an E or something stupid, right? And Dar, that's H-R, Jamail, which is spelled just like it sounds. 12 to 3 Eastern, and you know, I have a couple of other invites out. Although, I don't know, man. I kind of got a late start on getting people on the show today. Yeah, I'm kind of lazy that way sometimes. 12:30 Eastern, some links. Yeah, so today on the show, James Bamford and Dar Jamail. When I saw pictures of Bamford and Snowden, Bamford and Greenwald hanging out down in Rio a few months ago, maybe as long as almost a year ago now, I thought, well, great. Because, I mean, Glenn and Ed must have given Jim some stuff. Hey, James, you want to break a few Snowden stories? Here you go. Why, that's what I would have said if I was Glenn Greenwald, right? He would have been able to get Ed Snowden to agree to that. Hey, Bamford's here in Rio. How about we let him look at a couple of things and write him up? But then what happened? Well, apparently, they made an even better deal than that. Bamford went to Russia, and he interviewed Ed Snowden, and he broke two or three or four stories. That's not actually why he's going to be on the show. Well, yeah, it is, kind of, sort of. Yeah, you already know. I don't like doing the teasers and all the promotional hypey stuff or whatever. The story is that the Snowden documents show, as Greenwald reported in The Guardian, the NSA hands over virtually the entire hall to the Israelis every day, including all their, you know, everything they know about the congressmen, the judges, and everything else. And the Israelis use it how they will, apparently. And so, of course, Bamford's written about the NSA's relationship with the Israelis in the past, especially in his book, The Shadow Factory, but also in articles, too. He's kind of got a background on that. And it came up this week. It's actually important. I saw Greg Mitchell. I think I forgot to retweet it. I'm coming, Greg. I'm going to retweet you. Greg Mitchell tweeted out that a year ago, here he was mocking the New York Times and calling them out. Oh, no, I did retweet. Okay, good. For not covering this important revelation in The Guardian. Now, it wasn't a, and the New York, The Guardian ended up giving a lot of documents, maybe their whole haul of documents to the New York Times, and all their different reporters, many of their different reporters have done Snowden stories. But even on the ones that other papers broke, like Greenwald would publish an article in Poland or in Thailand or wherever, if it was relevant, right, for their people to know. And then that would end up getting coverage in the New York Times. Oh, guess what, everybody? It's news that another news story was published somewhere because it was a new Greenwald-Snowden joint. And it appeared in the Thailand Daily Press, or whatever the hell, I'm making that up. And here's what it said. But when it came to Greenwald has published an article in The Guardian, with documents showing that the NSA turns over their whole hall to the Israelis every day. That wasn't worth a mention in the New York Times for some reason. Isn't that strange? Well, now, there are a bunch of refuseniks in Israel. Israeli military members of their NSA, it's called Unit 8200, apparently. I don't know if they've changed the name now already or what, but anyway. And these guys are refusing to continue spying on Palestinian civilians in order to compromise them, blackmail them, force them to betray their people, etc., etc. Not going to do it anymore. They're pushing back, and so Bamford took the opportunity to write an essay for the New York Times saying, oh, hey, as long as we're talking about what the Israeli spies know about the Palestinians, let's talk about what the Americans give them about the Palestinians, Palestinian Americans, conversations including American citizens that end up being useful to the Israelis for not intelligence purposes, but just, you know, politics. Less legitimate than, than intelligence purposes somehow. All right, anyway. So that's Bamford. He's going to be on the show to talk about that. And then I'm going to try to ask him about as much as I can remember from that Wired thing. There was the Monster Mind thing. Hey, chat room guys, you all read the thing in Wired, Bamford, Snowden, and all that about a month and a half ago or something? What else is in there other than the NSA caused the Syrian blackout and blamed it on Assad and the Monster Mind thing? And there's something else. I'm following Ed Snowden's lawyer, Ben Wisner. Is it Wisner or Windsor? Anyway, from the ACLU. And that's his, you know, on Twitter, on people's profile, they have their kind of background image. That's his background image. I mean, it's the picture is so perfect and awesome that you would think it was faked and photoshopped by Industrial Light and Magic or whatever it's called now under Disney. You would think it's fake. It's just too perfect of Snowden and General Hayden together in their finest tuxedos at some, you know, evil people's ball or whatever they call it when these government parasites get together at our expense. Snow's just beaming, you know, he's got this great look on his face. Here I am with Michael Hayden, the guy whose fault 9/11 is. Oh, you know what? As long as I'm... Oh, and Dar Jamail's going to be on because he knows all about Iraq, and I'm going to ask him a bunch of Iraq stuff. Oh, man, no, I forgot. What was my awesome... Oh, I know what it was. My awesome Bamford anecdote I'm going to tell you right now that I have a couple of minutes, and I'm talking about Bamford, and I just mentioned Hayden. Bamford's... I think it's like the introduction or the prologue or what have you to the Shadow Factory. Or no, or is it... It might have been a pretext for war. 9/11 Iraq and the abuse of America's intelligence agencies. I think it was that one. Anyway... Or maybe it was the Shadow Factory. Anyway, one of them starts out with, yeah, so here I am interviewing Michael Hayden in his office before 9/11. And Michael Hayden is saying to me that if Osama bin Laden himself walked across a bridge from Canada to the United States, he would not legally be able to spy on him. And how that is absolutely patently ridiculous. What are you talking about? Of course you have the authority to spy on him. It's not like it's hard to prove, or certainly not hard to make the FISA court believe that Osama bin Laden is an agent of a foreign power or a terrorist group. And then you have all you need. You don't need a probable cause. All you need is not even a reasonable suspicion. You just need a you think so. What are you talking about, Michael Hayden? And then later 9/11 happened on his watch. Kind of makes you wonder just how deaf and dumb he was playing there and why, doesn't it? Make you wonder? Makes me wonder. You should read that book, man, The Shadow Factory, really. Well, shouldn't boss you around. Yeah, if you want to. Hey, all Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Live in La Vida Baroca by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. Well, I never was able to interview Jim when his Wired story about Snowden was brand new. So now I don't remember all the different parts of it. But anyway, we got enough to talk about here with in 2 10-minute segments about connections with Israel. Between the NSA and Unit 8200 and what they're up to, and then maybe we can go back in time to the Naris Verint stuff. I don't know. That's old, though. You can go back and look that up. Listen to my old interviews with Jim about all that. Then we need to talk about Monster Mind. I don't know. Maybe I need to, the top of the hour break, if I can remember, I'll go back and scan through. It's a really long article, though, that Wired thing. Go through there and try to remember as much of what I might have wanted to ask him about it back when I first read it. Anyway. So, the great James Bamford will be on the show. Also, Dar Jamail, he was an unembedded reporter in Iraq back in the last war. And he's done a lot of reporting since there, not after the fall of Mosul, but before. He's gone back, I think, a couple of times in the last, say, most of a year or something like that. Went to Fallujah back in January or something, I think. Something. Anyway. He really knows his stuff, and I want to give him a chance to talk about the strategy for war. There's a Senate hearing going on now, and I'm tempted to turn up the audio and just listen, but I hate to waste everybody's precious time. I'll tell you, I saw... It's a Senate hearing. Is it Armed Services? I think it's the Armed Services Committee. Is it the Senate or the House? I think it's... Well, the closed caption is running all over the other caption at the bottom. Anyway, the damn point is the Secretary of Defense, as they call him, Chuck Hagel, went up there. And he said, yeah, we're doing this. And he said, never mind what you heard about the generals disagreeing with Obama about ground troops. We're not doing ground troops. And the generals agree with that. And you can put that to bed. Well, I think we maybe need to talk about that a little bit. You should read Josh Rogan and Eli Lake's take. They're very hawkish, kind of neoconish reporters. I sort of like Josh. You know, Eli Lake is a damned liar. But Josh Rogan, I don't think I've ever caught him being a liar before, and he gets some great stories, and I just disagree with him, but I think he's an okay guy, and I mean, I don't, he puts himself in the category with Lake, but I keep him separate. Lake really lied you into the last Iraq war in a horrible couple of ways, so that's different. But anyway, well, and he's been bad on everything. But anyway, Josh Rogan and Eli Lake have a story at the Daily Beast about, and the whoever wrote the headline wrote it from your and my point of view. Wow, does Obama still control the generals? And they want ground troops, and they keep saying so, even though he already said the policy was otherwise. Only their argument slants toward the what's the matter with the president. And over on Fox News, it's completely out of control. Over on, well, I was watching Hannity last night. And the story basically is that Barack Obama is insubordinate. The generals are saying we need ground forces. And the president is refusing to give them what they need to get the job done, blah, blah, blah. You heard it a million times before. Here it is again. How, it's not brand new, but it is the most worrying fact on the planet, I think. That's a major narrative in our society, one that people are so used to hearing, they don't even question the truth of it. How dare that civilian president tell the generals no when they know what's best? They're the generals. That can lead to your totalitarian slavery, understand? Very quickly. And I'm not saying it's about to happen kind of thing, but I'm just saying, no, wrong. It doesn't matter, especially when we're talking about the president is the one being restrained. You know, when the Pentagon is telling the president, we don't want to attack Assad in Syria, then I'm kind of thankful for that. It helps undermine his political case for war. He doesn't do it. I don't mind that kind of insubordination so much. But when he's the one being restrained and they're the ones who want to go to more war, it is their right, duty, obligation, 1,000%, and nothing but to shut up. If they want to complain about it, they can complain about it in their resignation speech or in private to the president. Remember in 2009 when Stanley McChrystal and David Petraeus just kept leaking and leaking and leaking to the media and to the Republicans who then talked to the media about how Barack Obama's not giving us what we want. He's not giving us what we need to get the job done. Of course, he ended up, after the dithering criticism withered him, he gave them their extra 30,000 troops, and then they still failed anyway. McChrystal first, then Petraeus finished up the failure. And right now, they're leaving Afghanistan mostly, and they're only leaving enough soldiers there to try to bide their time so that you will have completely forgotten Afghanistan before the Taliban come riding right back into Kabul. Boy, is Christian Amanpour going to freak out. Anyway. Obama's insubordinate. The generals know what's best, and the president is obstructing them again, is the narrative from the right in America. And it's, boy, does that bother the hell out of me. It ought to bother you. But anyway, here's the other thing about it, is Obama's setting this up for them perfectly. Why? Because he's a damned liar. He and Chuck Hagel both. Chuck Hagel is saying our policy is to destroy the Islamic State. It's going to take years, and we're going to go about it real slow, and we're not going to have a single guy of ours firing a single rifle. Just drones and F-18s, we swear to God. It's an existential threat to every man, woman, and child in America. Something must be done. They must be crushed. They must be destroyed. We must launch a preemptive war against them. But, you know, just kind of quarter-assed. We're going to launch a drone war against a state. Like it's a tiny group of rebels in Yemen or Somalia. Or, you know, tribesmen in the hinterlands of northwestern Pakistan. And so, of course, the entire right-wing argument is, that's absolutely ridiculous. If you're right that you got to do this, then do it right. Don't you send our drones out there in harm's way and get them, you know, shot down in vain or, you know, anything like that. Because, and just think about what it's going to look like if Baghdadi is still giving sermons 2 months from now, 6 months from now, a year from now. Think the Democrats can put up with that? With that kind of criticism from the right? I said it before a lot of times. I bet Gareth Porter $10. They're invading by New Year's. I think really by Thanksgiving. You'll see the Army and Marines on the ground there. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. And they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right. I'm Scott Horton. Oh, yeah, you know, Bamford seems to think that there's another NSA source. I don't know if I want to waste interview time asking him that, but is there another Snowden out there? That's an important point. I'm sitting here trying to reread this 10,000-word article during the commercial breaks. That'll work great. Anyway, hey, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the Liberty Radio Network starting at noon every weekday, noon to 3 Eastern time. And I got a chat room up and going at scotthorton.org/chat. It's an IRC free node chat. So if you already are doing IRC stuff or whatever like that, it's just hashtag Scott Horton Show. But you can just go to scotthorton.org/chat, pull it right up there, fake name and a caption, you're in. Come say hi to the people. And yeah, all that. You can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show and retweet me because I'm just so great at tweeting. You'll want to. All right. So yeah, the war. It's a strategy for failure. It's an announced, premeditated failure plot. And I am not recommending any action whatsoever, other than complete and total and absolute withdrawal of all U.S. government everything from the Middle East forever. In fact, I'd like the USA to cease to exist, actually. I mean, I'd like the country to still be here, but the government to just not exist. And if it doesn't exist, then it can't do things. So that's really the solution to our foreign policy problem, ultimately, is to abolish the Congress, the presidency, the Supreme Court, and all their appointed lackeys and pretended powers. And I'm not saying that I prefer a better strategy to this terrible one in any sense either. There's no disclaimer like, well, I'm against intervention, but if you're going to intervene, then you got to do it right. No, you don't. You don't have to do it right. Don't do it at all. Stop it. Now, all that being disclaimed, it is important to point out that these guys have a strategy for absolute failure. Political and military failure. There is no force on the ground in Iraq that can take back the major cities that belong to ISIS. Maybe not even the minor ones. Oh, this is a different category. I need to get to that later. Yeah, here's the article I was looking for. Kurds not ready to recapture Mosul, says Iraqi minister. Yeah, that's right. The Kurdish Peshmerga and the Iraqi army are incapable of rooting out the Islamic State. And especially if you use the so-called Iraqi army to do it, which just means the Shiite army, then you're just doubling down on picking the Shiite side of a sectarian war in that country and rallying that many more people to Al-Qaeda's cause or ISIS's cause. Sorry, I thought I was giving this exact same speech in 2005. But anyway. And could have been before that. The Peshmerga can't do it. I thought I had the link here. I had it yesterday where... Oh, no, it's here at antiwar.com. Where General Dempsey says half of the Iraqi army, half of it, the one that George Bush stood up so that we could stand down, is unable to fight with us. So the Iraqi army, according to Dempsey, can't do the job. The Kurdish Peshmerga can't do the job. And if the Iraqi army and the Kurdish Peshmerga can't do it, then that also means that the best that you could, quote-unquote best, the most, I guess, that you could expect from the Iraqi Shiite militias, like the Badr Brigade, the part of it that's not already, just a.k.a. the Iraqi army, but the Badr Brigade, the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr, and then their other break-off groups, the... What is it called, the Al-Haq thing? I always get it wrong. Al-Haq. I ought to just Google it, right? Asabe. It's the B that always throws me off. I know it doesn't end with an H. There's an H in there somewhere. But always, yeah. It's Asabe Al-Haq. Or Al-Al-Haq. But you only get one Al out of me, you bastards. Anyway, they're basically the Sadrists or a breakoff of the Sadrists. Those guys, the most you could expect from them is that they will rally to fight to protect the holy Shiite shrines in Samarra, Karbala, Najaf. That's their priority. Kicking ISIS out of Mosul is not their priority, and it's beyond their ability. The Turks could do it, but they're not gonna. And it would probably blow up in their face, too. I mean, they could march in there and dislodge ISIS from Mosul, but then what? And they're not going to do it. In fact, this doesn't get much coverage in America, but dozens and dozens, like 70-something, I believe, important Turkish citizens, diplomats, etc., were kidnapped and are being held hostage by ISIS in Mosul. And this is the biggest deal in the world in Turkey. And so Erdogan dare not deliberately provoke the murder of all these hostages, tens and tens and tens of hostages. I think it's less than 100, but more than 70, I think, was the number I read of it. So Turkey, they're compromised right the hell out of here, and they wouldn't do it anyway. They wouldn't even let the Americans launch attacks from their air bases. They got to keep flying from the SS George H.W. This will not be another Vietnam, he said back in 1990, Bush, there in the Persian Gulf. Where the F-18s are out of gas probably twice before they even get up to Kurdistan, right? They got to have fuel tankers in the air. Where do the fuel tankers tank off from? Italy? And then, or Diego Garcia? And then who refuels the refuel tankers? How long can they fly circles before they got to go back home and be relieved again? Like, what a boondoggle these wars are. It's just crazy. Anyway, the boondoggle's the least of it. It's the blood that matters and the consequences coming for more blood later. The strategy can't possibly work. And that's the part that more people, at least if you listen to TV news or you read Twitter accounts of think tanker types and national security types on Twitter, you know, this is the part that they think could work. At least we have a government in Baghdad that wants us to come and help them. Oh, that's right. The Iraqi Prime Minister Abadi is saying we don't want U.S. ground troops at all. You're not welcome. Take your air power only. But that's as much cooperation as the U.S. is going to get out of him. At least he's posturing that way. But as compared to Syria, where the American policy is de-Ba'athification in the middle of an insurgency by al-Nusra and ISIS, al-Nusra just being al-Qaeda in Syria, and ISIS being al-Qaeda in Syria up until they decided that they wanted to go their own way and declare a state now rather than wait. And so anyway, the strategy in Syria makes far less sense than the strategy in Iraq. The strategy in Syria is to train up the Sunni base insurgency to fight the Sunni base insurgency. They're trying to do like an awakening type situation like they pulled in Iraq back in 06. Although that, they don't seem to be talking about trying to replicate that in Iraq this time. But they're trying to do that, and not really. I mean, sort of, kind of. With this FSA, they're going to train up 5,000 fighters. What are you even talking about? You're going to train up 5,000 fighters to be some sort of moderate army in Syria to fight ISIS, Nusra, and the Syrian state at the same time. No one believes this is going to happen. In fact, there's a story at Huffington Post today by a guy who, he's broken national security stories before. This guy, Grimm, has the CIA, partially for bureaucratic reasons, saying they think this whole plan is terrible because it's the Pentagon's plan, and also it's terrible. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm sorry, of course, it's a House hearing that's on right now, not a Senate hearing, about Iraq War 3 getting going here. It's on C-SPAN 3 right now. And here's my thing. I don't believe that Barack Obama doesn't want to send ground troops.
I think he's already decided he's going to send ground troops. I think Barack Obama is a liar. I think he knows good and well when he says, I am not sending your boys off to fight in any foreign wars. He's lying as bad as FDR was when he claimed it too. Because, I don't know. Because, damn it, I have to assume at least room temperature IQ in the Oval Office when they're discussing these things. Who is gonna sack Mosul and kick ISIS out of it is a question that must be raised. The Kurds aren't gonna do it. The Iraqi army ain't gonna do it. So who's gonna do it, Obama? I would have to believe that that part of the discussion is not happening in his presence anywhere. And I don't believe that. And I know he's just a figurehead, this, that, the other thing, whatever. It's still his call. Still his signature on the paper. Still his orders or his insistence that X, Y, or Z resign if they don't like it. Any of us could put themselves in his shoes. And see how easy it could be. Say, oh, you mean everyone at the CIA and the Pentagon's really frustrated with me, huh? Tough. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that the executive branch would not remove their own leader one way or the other if he tried. I'm just saying if I was president, I'd go for it. I wouldn't care. Same for you, right? Anyway, it's on him. And so, I mean, come on, man. It's fantasy to say we're going to destroy him, but without trying. No, you're not. Bombing him from the air is just going to make him stronger. So, next. Next is ground troops. Now, I had a big, long conversation with Gareth Porter on the phone after my last interview with him. On the show, what, Friday or whatever, it was the last segment, and we just kept arguing for about an hour after that, I guess. We bet $10, and now Gareth Porter, even though he's a progressive type, he is very much a public choice individualist sort when it comes to the politics of bureaucracy and how decisions are made by these pigs. And it's all about domestic politics. It is all about domestic politics. Well, I agree with that, 100%. But Gareth thinks that what the people think matters at all, and I don't. Domestic politics to me just means what's the compromise point between, J.P. Morgan Chase and Lockheed and the generals. You know, what can they agree on, what they want to do? And of course, the Israel lobby has a say, too, a very powerful say. I didn't mean to leave them out. But the American people can go to hell as far as the U.S. government is concerned. If they decide that we, quote-unquote, meaning you and your kin, gotta go reinvade Iraq to do something about this thing, and the polls say no, they'll do it anyway. And they'll tell themselves they're heroes for doing the right thing. This is why a republic is better than a democracy. Because sometimes your betters just have to decide for you. That's why you chose us, they'll say. And then they'll go to war anyway. Hell, they've already sent more than 1,000 soldiers. We're not sending soldiers. There's 1,000 soldiers. Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers reported on the quote-unquote secret CIA base near Erbil, Kurdistan, back in early July. And he said, CIA, Rangers, and Delta, meaning first and second tier, second and first tier, special forces there in chronological order there, the way I said it. Navy SEALs, Delta Force, and then Army Rangers, along with CIA, rebuilding the base. Daily flights, hourly, whatever. Regular flights coming in, bringing equipment. Rebuilding this former CIA base. And the headline was, secret CIA base with scare quotes around secret. And Prothero explained on this show, He didn't mind revealing it. He didn't, and he wouldn't have, but he sure as hell didn't mind revealing it, because when he was looking for it, his cab driver said, "Oh, I know. Are you looking for the CIA base? Yeah, I'll take you there." Because there's nothing secret about it. So that was why Secret got the scare quotes. And it was funny because I interviewed him for about, you know, 20 minutes or something. And I was like, "Hey, wait a minute. We're burying the lead in this interview. America's reinvading Iraq. You got the scoop, Prothero. They're reinvading Iraq. They're building up a giant base near Erbil. And then from there, they're killing people. And will be soon enough. It's already on." He said the drones are already buzzing in the air all day. That was in early July, so. In fact, let me make sure the date on that. I don't want to tell you wrong. What if I got a footnote wrong? Let's see. So we go, Prothero CIA base. That should be enough right there. July 11th. That counts as late early July or early mid-July, I guess. July 11th, 2014, Erbil, Iraq expansion of secret, quote-unquote, secret facility in Iraq suggests closer U.S.-Kurd ties, is the article there. So, there's your no boots on the ground. There's more than 1,000 now. What, 1,400-something boots on the ground now? And the generals, when they were insubordinate day before yesterday talking bad about what the president thinks, they were saying, yes, of course, we will have to embed American special forces in with these Iraqi army brigades to lead them. So that's just coming up. Given the assumptions of the American empire, there's just no way around it other than, I don't know, 2 of the 300 million people in this country just absolutely screaming hell no. And what does it take to make them do that? Not the last time around. The last time around is not enough to make them say no to this one. And so, I don't know. Place your bets. And by the way, I saw Rand Paul on Sean Hannity last night. I told you I'm trying to switch back to Fox News. Just go ahead and give it to me in the very worst kind of a way. I want to know what most TV news watching people are watching. Oh, it's horrifyingly stupid mostly. But anyway, it's not really dumber than CNN, I guess. Just different. You know. But anyway, I saw Rand Paul on Hannity and he said the same thing again. So now I know this is his new little talking point. He already said it to Reason the other day. Now on Hannity last night, he said, if we should have been protecting the embassy in Benghazi, well, then we should protect the embassy in Erbil. Well, it wasn't an embassy in Benghazi. It wasn't even a makeshift consulate. It was basically a CIA front. It was the State Department side of the same operation with the CIA, where they were funneling jihadis and guns to Syria, as Rand Paul himself has accused. There's no embassy, and he knows it. But then he says, well, geez, since the lack of security at the Benghazi CIA jihadi gun-running crime base thing was a big scandal, I guess the only answer in a situation like this is America must protect American interests in Erbil no matter what. Send in the drones at least, whatever it takes. And then in his Reason interview, way down in the interview, he goes, you know, I guess an argument could be made that we could just withdraw those people. We could withdraw the embassy. And they withdraw embassy staff from places all over the world all the time, right? But no, if ISIS is coming, you don't withdraw your embassy staff. You launch a war over it. But then he said the same thing last night. And then you know what he said? I swear to God, Rand Paul invoked Franklin Delano Roosevelt and called him a great leader. I swear to God, he called him a great leader for going to Congress and getting a declaration of war and said that's what Obama should do now. A full-scale declaration of war against ISIS. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to, the thing. Let's see. In the chat room, they said, Rand added the hedge word. FDR was a great leader for that moment. Nah, sorry. Too late. He later backpedaled. This is not good enough for me. What? Did I just say FDR is a great leader? I mean, you know, just that one time. Yeah, that one time when he got us into World War II. Yeah, that was great. Obama should be just like that. He should lead us into war in Iraq. Pretty disingenuous of me to present it that way, huh? Rand Paul said that Barack Obama should climb up Capitol Hill, call a joint session of both houses of Congress, and ask for a declaration of war to begin an aggressive war, the third one, against Iraq. And he cited the great dictator Franklin Roosevelt as the model to follow. President for life, the American Benito Mussolini. The father of the atomic bomb, Franklin Roosevelt. The father of the military-industrial complex. Handjob buddies with Uncle Joe the Butcher Stalin. And the guy who set up 3,500 boys to be exploded and or drowned to death at Pearl Harbor as an excuse to get into a war in Europe. Great leader. How dare I slander Rand Paul like that when all Rand Paul is doing is trying to cite FDR as the example that the current president should follow in declaring Iraq War III. Geez, Scott Horton, why don't you just give Rand Paul the benefit of the doubt more? Like, no matter what, even if he's for war. Even if he says to Sean Hannity, I'm for this, man. Let's do it. I just kind of, you know, quibble with McCain on the details a little bit. I just think that we should have a real declaration, like a good technicalitarian. But then I'm for the policy. Jeez, I mean, I guess we could just withdraw all our interests out of there and it wouldn't matter, right? But nah, anyway. If it was right to protect Benghazi, it's right to protect Erbil. That's my new talking point, I say. He says. That and the great leader, FDR, is the model to follow for getting us into this one. Yeah, well, this one might just have a world war for a title by the time it's over. Rand Paul. Jesus Christ. I mean, if he's any other Republican, I don't care. Republicans are Republicans. I mean, I care, but this is like a special case, man. It's just tragic. I'm sorry. I should, you know, be way over it by now, but I'm just not. It just kills me. Absolutely kills me. By the way, the Australia beheadings plot, does anyone know if this was a put-up job or not yet? Now, the thing is, at this point in 2014, something like this, I think, is within the realm of possibility that you would have, you know, Acela guys, wherever they're from, who would decide to do something like this. There's a story that apparently only Fox is covering, and I'm not sure why. But there's a guy who shot and killed three innocent people just at random and then told the cops he did it because of American foreign policy. And I understand, actually, or, well, I don't want to assume a good motive for the media sucking at anything. If I had to imagine a good motive, I could see how maybe they'd be reticent to encourage and provoke Islamophobia in America. Next thing you know, get a bunch of idiots come out and attack a bunch of Sikhs who ain't got nothing to do with Islam anyway. Or maybe they do, but just a little bit. But they sure as hell ain't got nothing to do with bin Ladenism or whatever. Salafism. Oh, but they wear funny hats, so get them is good enough for the kind of people who would, you know, go out and hurt someone because of what it looks like, what religion they might believe in. So I could see why people be resident, maybe, to that's why I might be resident to talk about it. But nah, man, this is an important thing. And it's absolutely crazy, and I would always assume, nah, he must have been put up to it by the FBI in a case like this or whatever. But after this long of permanent war in a row now, I think, you know, from time to time, we are going to have domestic terrorists, and maybe the Australians will too, that are not sting operations by the FBI. And there have been two this week of people attempting to go join ISIS who were just duped by the FBI into thinking they were going to join ISIS, which is, I guess, better than entrapping them into trying to kill people in their own town and that kind of thing, which is what the FBI is specialized in. And really, I could not possibly overstate that. Read the book by the great journalist Trevor Aronson called The Terror Factory. In fact, he did an article-length version of it that's out of date now or whatever, but still pretty awesome. But his book just, man, there are 50 cases of and plus of outright entrapment. Couldn't overstate that. However, there's also the case of Faisal Shahzad, who went to Pakistan, saw the results of America's drone war, got radicalized, came back, tried to blow up Times Square. There's also, who was not put up to it by the FBI in any sense. Then there's also, is it Abdullah Zazi? I forget his first name. But Zazi is his last name. He was the Denver cab driver who went to try to do a plot in New York. And that one was discovered and stopped by, I think it was the British intelligence, got his emails or something. Anyway, they ended up busting him before he was able to. I think his plan was to attack the subways in New York. That was another not FBI put up job. And so this kind of thing could happen. Now, on the other hand, there have been a lot of put up jobs, man, and including a beheading plot in Canada a few years back. Speaking of the British Commonwealth, which is what they call the Empire now, because Empire. That's bad PR. But anyway, well, I guess it's not much of an empire anymore. It's the American Empire now is what it is. But anyway, remember that one in Canada back in, oh, I don't know, 05 or 06 or 07 or something? There was supposedly a big plot by a bunch of jihadists to behead a bunch of people, including the prime minister and this and that. And the whole thing was completely fanciful. And it turned out that, yeah, of course it was a con from the beginning. The whole thing was set up by informants and federal police from the beginning. And, anyway, in this case in Australia, they've arrested 15 people. Details remain scant, so we don't really know yet whether this is a put-on or not. But assume it's not for the sake of argument. There's only one solution, is to stop intervening in the Middle East. It's so far out of control. The problem is, then you're making the mistaken assumption that the national interests of the vast masses of the populations of the United States, Australia, etc., are the national interests in the mind of the people running the governments of these countries, and that's just where the logic breaks down. They don't care about us at all. They don't care about their own damn towers. You know, those World Trade Center towers were nicknamed Nelson and David Rockefeller after the governor and chief banker of New York, who worked together. Guess what? In the most fascist, crony capitalist type of a way, for State of New York guaranteed loans by the Chase Bank to build the damn towers and to roll over as much of the cost as they possibly could onto the people of New York. But anyway, a bunch of towers full of civilians. That's the price we pay for empire. That's been said in D.C. before. In fact, man, I hadn't thought of that in a long time. Now I forget. Who was it that said that? That was somebody at the DOD, right? 9/11 is... It wasn't... It was like they meant it. They weren't being sarcastic or critical or whatever. Is the price... Who said that? We pay for empire. Uh I'm sure a lot of people said it, but the original quote was like one of the neocons in the Pentagon, wasn't it? On the Defense Policy Board or something? I'm going to find it at the break right now.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
That's so funny, man. I tweeted out this article. I talked about it yesterday. U.S. airstrikes boost Islamic State, according to the FBI. So I just tweeted that out, and then I got an answer back. The story that comes up has nothing to do with what you're talking about.
What? That's funny because
I don't want to hit refresh on this browser. It's the right link. U-airstrikes boost Islamic State. More hostages possible. And see, yeah, so the link is still correct. But now if you click it, it goes to top U.S. security threats, lone wolves, Syria fighters. Ha! That's so funny. The link still has the old headline. / Winston Smith. Jesus Christ, dude. You know what? I remember in third grade, we read a short story about kids who had little tablet computers and they read all their books on their little handheld tablet computers. And I don't know if I'd been watching The Outer Limits or what, man. I was a little ass kid. How old are you in third grade? Like 10 or something? 9? And I immediately was suspicious. And said no, because if all the books are all just on computers like that, then that means that, you know, surreptitious powers can come in and change what it says. And then no one will ever be able to prove what was the original fact as it was written down forever kind of thing. I really am a natural born libertarian. That's a real problem with libertarianism, right? If those of us who believe in it are simply determined to think we have free will. Don't like authority so much. Think I might have just been born this way. Amazing how they cut that out of there. Amazing. Amazingly amazing and cool. Check my Twitter feed for all of this crap. And the link still has the old headline. Nice job, Winston. You failed. All right, coming up on the show, James Bamford's going to be here to talk about the NSA's relationship with Israel. And so that should be good. Darja Mail's going to be on to talk about the war in Iraq. And I just found out by way of email this moment that Michael Scheuer is going to be on the show today as well. Michael Scheuer, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. We're going to see what he has to say about the new Iraq war. The last time I spoke to Michael Scheuer was in April, and I was predicting war against the new caliphate taking shape in eastern Syria and western Iraq. And he was going, yeah, no, Boko Haram. And I was going, yeah, yeah, Boko Haram. But wait a minute. Back to Syria. It seems to me obvious they're going to reinvade. They'll have to. What the hell else are they going to do? The Iraqi government can't control that territory. And that was before ISIS, if you're paying attention, that's 2 months before ISIS went rolling on into Mosul. Anyway, so I'll be asking him about what should be done. I've mentioned a couple of times I've been very pleasantly surprised to see him recommend against backing Assad. Because he's saying even though Assad is obviously the only force in Syria that can kill ISIS, it shouldn't be because we help him. That just makes it more our problem. At this point, let it be his problem. Just stop arming people against him. and let him do it, but don't help him do it. Don't ally with Iran and Iraq, and don't ally with Assad in Syria. And so, and he was saying that to Lou Dobbs on Fox, where, you know, that kind of message isn't as welcome. So, I'll be really interested to hear what Michael Scheuer has to say about what should be done about ISIS, et cetera, et cetera. I haven't been reading his website. I guess I should pull up nonintervention.com. That's what it is, non-intervention. Non-intervention.com. So, yeah, I do not know what his last few articles have been about. Maybe I'll try to look through them at the break here. Oh, yeah, this is going to be in just a few minutes. It's already the bottom of the second hour, ain't it? It is. Obama versus Islamic State. Here comes more debt, more death, and another lost war. This is, yeah, I can't wait to read this and interview him about it in just a minute. Michael Scheuer, former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, on the show in just a few minutes. Followed by James Bamford and Dar Jamil. And you know, there's a story of that Scheuer tells of how he couldn't get George Tenet to force the NSA to turn over all the intercepts that they were getting from the Yemen switchboard house, which was, I guess, Hani Hanjour's father-in-law's house, one of the hijackers' father-in-laws. And that was like the switchboard house where they would take all the calls from Afghanistan and everywhere else. And the NSA was monitoring it, and they would not give the stuff to the CIA. And the CIA guys like Scheuer and his buddies went to Tenet to demand that Tenet go to NSA and demand that they turn over the damn intercepts. And then Tenet just wouldn't do it, as Scheuer put it, because he lacked the moral courage. Even though he was the DCI above the NSA, the boss of the director of the NSA at the time. And so the CIA resorted to building their own microwave interception station on Madagascar, but even then they were only stuck listening to half the conversation instead of the full one. And that's not to acquit them for 9/11 happening on their watch too and all of that. In fact, on George Tenet's watch more than anybody probably. But it just goes to show how all these guys just hate each other so much. You know, I asked Scheuer before about John O'Neill, and he said, well, 9/11 was all his fault. All he wanted to do was take every bit of intelligence they had about Al-Qaeda and make it secret in front of a grand jury in New York somewhere, while you know, people like him were trying to target and kill these guys. And so to them, the FBI was a greater enemy than the enemy. So much they hate each other, these government official types. Shouldn't be surprising. And I'm not saying that it acquits any of them at all. It acquits Scheuer because he was banished to the library starting in 1999 because he kept complaining about Sandy Berger and et cetera, shutting down every attempted plan that they had to kill Bin Laden back then. And so he had been kicked out of the Bin Laden unit long before 9/11, before the Malaysia meeting or any of that stuff, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, that's in James Bamford's book. James Bamford wrote all about that in The Shadow Factory. Which is his book on 9/11 and all the illegal spying, too. Well, it's his second book on 9/11, really, and all the illegal spying, too. Bamford notes that the letters NSA don't even appear in the 9/11 Commission report anywhere. You know that? They did not even ask the question, huh, what did the NSA know and not share? They didn't even ask. They didn't want to know. I never read it. I don't want to be confused by their propaganda. To quote Ron Paul in a different context. Oh, that sounds terrible. Does that sound terrible to you guys, or is it just me? Boy, I better call Ian.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Well, I got a terrible audio problem from the LRN feed here in the studio, but I hope it still sounds okay to you guys out there. Pretty sure it should be. All right. Our first guest on the show today is Michael Scheuer. He's the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit, and he wrote the books Through Our Enemy's Eyes, Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terrorism, Marching Toward Hell, America and Islam After Iraq, and I guess he meant the last Iraq War, and then the biography, Osama Bin Laden. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us on the show today. I'm very interested in what all you have to say about what's been going on in Iraq since June. The last time we spoke was, I believe, in April, and I was predicting that America would be reinvading Iraq in order to fight the rise of the new caliphate between Syria and Iraq, and then seems like that's exactly what's going on. But I haven't heard from you since then. So, except I saw you speaking with Lou Dobbs on Fox News, and we'll get to that in a minute because there are some interesting things to talk about there. But I'm not sure where to start. I think you probably got a better idea of where to begin with what you have to say about America's new Iraq policy, the new Iraq war.
Well, it's, you know, Scott, it's a continuation of the crap we've been doing for the past 15 years, or almost 20 years now since Bin Laden declared war. When you listen to these people, whether it's Boehner or the president or the Secretary of Defense or Dempsey, the Joint Chiefs Chairman, it's the same old song over and over again. This has nothing to do with Islam. There's a limited number of these people. We can beat them with air support and one at a time. And if you step back and look at the map of the world, they're on four different continents now and in control in a number of places. We have let this become, from a minor cavity, it has now become a root canal. And the president clearly and the Republicans clearly don't have an idea of what they've done in terms of causing this war or motivating this war by continuing to intervene in everywhere in the Middle East, continuing to support Saudi Arabia and the other tyrannies of Arabs and supporting the Israelis. This is a world war, Scott. And you can say, we're not waging a war against Islam till you're blue in the face. And what the truth is that every day a greater part of Islam is waging war against us. And so ultimately we lose if we don't wise up a little. But I think the odds against us wising up are very, very long.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, so, I mean, there's a lot to discuss there, but just, you know, basically on the starting point there of the motive of those who fight us, you know, to people who aren't all that familiar with this debate as it's taken place this whole time, maybe the last they heard, you know, they hate us because we're free and because they're Islamic. And it's such a bad religion, Mike, that it tells people that they have to fight and kill and attack everyone who's not like them. And so it sounds halfway like that's what you're saying, that this is about Islam and Islam's at war with us. And, you know, what would Frank Gaffney say? Something along those lines. On the other hand, you turn right around and you say intervention over there, support for Israel over there, et cetera, et cetera. So I know I'm being overly simplistic, but which is it? How is it both? What do you say?
Why can't it be both, Scott? Islam is a religion just as Judaism is, or Sikhism, or Christianity was one that was worth a damn. If your religion is attacked, you defend it. And the people who are attacking us are attacking us for two reasons. Because we have supported for 60 years tyranny across the Muslim world. And that's the number one thing they're revolting against, and Israel. Tyranny in Israel, they regard tyranny regard Israel as a tyranny also. When they're responding to their faith, they're indeed being good Muslims. One of the great, great lies that has been told about people like Osama bin Laden is that they're bad Muslims. If you look at Islam, they're very good Muslims. They've taken upon themselves to defend their brethren because the kings, the generals, and the other tyrants in the Middle East wouldn't. The second reason beyond our support for those people is our intent, our deliberate policy of intervening in other people's wars. Libya is the most recent example. We've turned that into a hive of Islamists, which are going to be a problem for us into the future. We supported a free election in Egypt, then overthrew it and supported the military coup that took power. Our presence is what motivates these people. Do they hate the kind of freedom we have, the kind of liberty we have, gender equality, elections? Of course they hate it, but they're not going to fight against it. Who would blow themselves up because women go to the university? They blow themselves up because they want us out of their world. And what we've done is treat them as madmen, few in number, and with a gentle hand in terms of killing them. And unfortunately, none of it has worked. We're still at the starting line. And until we realize that this is preeminently a religious war, a war of a religion defending itself, we can neither understand the depth and the breadth of the motivation among young Muslim men, nor will we understand that there's a way to cut it short and redirect it by stopping this unholy intervention policy we have in the Middle East.
Now, so what about Syria? You mentioned Libya there, but then it seemed like what was such a big deal about Libya, other than the absolute chaos now, was supporting the Mujahideen, many of them veterans of the Iraq War, against Gaddafi, where they had fought Americans, against Gaddafi back in 2011. It turned the place upside down, and yet spread into Mali and this and that, but nobody in America anyway really cares that much about what happens in Mali. But the other part of it was that the Mujahideen and a hell of a lot of the weapons, including, you know, Gaddafi's old weapon stores, went for the next phase of the project, which was Syria. And so when we're not supporting the secular military dictator types, we're supporting revolutions against them. And I can't shake the idea, Michael, that this is like trying to debathify Saddam Hussein's government, or, you know, overthrow Saddam and debathify the government and abolish the army. But if Zarqawi's war had already been going on for a year and a half or 2 years or 3 years at that time, how in the world people look back on debathifying the army, debathifying the Iraqi state and the army and kicking all the Sunnis out of everything as helping lead to that massive insurgency. But can you imagine doing so in the middle of the insurgency? And then that's been our policy since 2011, even to this day, even after ISIS has grown up so strong, it's declared itself a real state.
And it has the monetary power and the bureaucratic power to control the area it's in. It is, in essence, it's a de facto state. People are working for it. People are prospering under it. People's wages are better than they were under either Maliki or Assad. It is a force to be reckoned with, but we don't understand that. We're completely inane. What difference does it make, Scott? If you're looking back into February 2011, what difference does it make who rules in Egypt or in Libya or anywhere else? If the people want to change their government and they don't get all killed and they succeed, good for them. We need to go back to Washington and Jefferson, who said, anybody who controls a country, we recognize and we deal with. Their internal problems are their own, but we do not try to overthrow them because we dislike their politics.
Yeah. All right, now, so what about the Islamic State? Because here, and I'm actually very curious about what you think about all the difference between them wanting to go ahead and declare a caliphate now in defiance of Zawahiri and splitting off from al-Qaeda, and what you think of that strategy and what's going to become of it?
Well, I think what we're seeing is a change in generation. The National Interest asked me to write a piece about a year, year and a half ago about what's going to happen after Zawahiri. And what we're seeing is a new generation coming into the leadership roles in all of these organizations. And I have to say, Scott, that we can point to differences between Zawahiri and Islamic State and al-Nusra Front, and all of that is true. But when you look at the bunch of them together, they're all going in the same direction. They may not be united, but they're all going in the same direction. They're trying to get rid of our allies, the Israelis, and they're trying to drive us out of the region. So there's really not... we shouldn't count on that factionalism to be of any benefit to us at all, really. But the point you were making is I forgot what the question was. I'm sorry.
It was very overly broad. Really, it was just what do you think of this? You know.
What I was saying is we're seeing a new generation, Scott. Mm-hmm. This guy Baghdadi, for example, it has what Osama bin Laden sorely lacked, which is a credential. He's a PhD in Islamic studies. More and more of the people we're seeing taking either political leadership or command leadership in the field are better educated than the first generation of al-Qaeda. We're seeing people who are more familiar with their religion and who have a much more vicious, if you will, or at least a much more militant view of how they need to go about defending it. And we're also seeing a generation that is extraordinarily savvy in terms of the tools of modernity, whether it's internet, videos, rifles, mortars, whatever it is. And so what we're seeing is a generation taking the place of the old one that is much more savvy in all the areas that are going to cause us problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, now a few different points here. First of all, as far as all these groups being basically the same, that's what Patrick Coburn says from walking around in Syria and talking to him. And, of course, we're seeing more and more of how all the different jihadi groups in Syria all get along and have ceasefires with each other and give each other American tow missiles and
what they really argue about is timing, Scott, as you pointed out. Zawahiri said now is not the time. Baghdadi and his boys said, yes, it is the time. And I think part of it, we have to keep in mind that Zawahiri wanted to declare the start of the caliphate in Afghanistan after we leave. Mm. And so there's a little bit of rivalry there.
Right.
But
personal rivalry, yeah.
Yeah, the one thing about an insurgency, one of the reasons it almost always wins is because they're factionalized. They fight each other, they disagree with each other, but there's no head to cut off. And we've certainly proved that with al-Qaeda. We've spent 15 years trying to cut off the head and have not yet realized it's not there.
Right. Yeah, they found bin Laden's caliphate. He was hiding in the attic even from his wife, which is a pretty funny end for him, if you ask me. But so now, you know, what I wonder, though, is if America does, and I think they're going to end up sending in the Marines because there's no other force that can dislodge these guys from Mosul to Crete, Fallujah. And so I think just under the assumptions of the empire, eventually they'll end up with another full-scale ground invasion and all that. But I wonder then if America ends up with any degree of victory over ISIS in that sense, whether that just gives a massive PR win and maybe more than just PR win to al-Qaeda, which proves their case that you can't attack, you can't win on the near front until you get rid of the far enemy first. It's just going to redouble everybody's efforts to attack inside the United States.
Scott, this is what we've seen in these three guys' heads getting kicked, cut off is not just barbarity or meanness. What we saw was the Islamic State putting a worm on a hook. The one thing they need more than anything is U.S. intervention on the ground in Iraq. And if it brings along ground troops from Sunni states fighting on the side of the Americans and the Shia, the more the better. And there's no one who has more respect in the United States for the Marine Corps than I have. But if they take those places back, the question becomes, then what? They will take them back because the Mujahideen will, as they always do, run away to fight again later.
Right.
Are we going to garrison that damn place for when? Like the Balkans for 20 years? And knowing that if we ever leave, the war starts again? It is a nonsense. Obama is a madman. Really, he deserves a nice little white jacket that ties in the back because he doesn't have a clue about what to do.
Yeah, in other words, what you're saying is he's doing nothing but provoke these guys, doing nothing to limit them. But so tell me then, if I could magically make you the national security advisor and you could put that straitjacket on him and force him to listen to you, what's the plan?
I think the first plan is to say to him, and for him to say that to the American people, you know, we don't like the fact that our two guys got their heads cut off, but this is a zero threat to U.S. national security. The people who did it are, and their allies are, But first, we have to have a discussion. Someone's got to tell the truth, Scott. These are not madmen. If we were fighting madmen, it would be a pleasure because they make mistakes, they can't organize. All of those things would play against them. But these are calculating, in many cases, well-educated individuals and street savvy in terms of how the world is. Obama and Clinton and Bush, the only world they could see was the world they wanted to be. And so they always lost because what they want is never coming and it's not out there at the moment. So my idea would be to for God's sake, do the pipeline, get rid of our dependence on anybody else for oil and dump the Saudis. And if our allies don't want to do that, fine. Let them stand by the Saudis and let them take the brunt. Better to kill Frenchmen than Americans. Israel, what in the world are we doing there? Our foreign policy of intervention has not only alienated the Muslim world, but it has absolutely destroyed Israel's security. I have no regard for the claim that Israel has a right to survive. No country has a right to survive. But it deserves to be able to defend itself to the extent it believes is necessary. And what we have done by taking out Saddam, by turning against Assad, by destroying Gaddafi, was to make sure that the Israelis now have the enemy, the Mujahideen, right on their borders everywhere, except Jordan, and Jordan is going to go if we intervene in the north. So I don't know, you know, what do you do? You stop motivating people to attack us and let them attack the people they would prefer to attack, the Israelis, the Saudis, the Shia. Let the war fester there. There's no real other choice. Our military is broken. They say the army is 450,000. One in three of those are shooters. They couldn't hold Virginia against the people who have rifles in Virginia. So, you know, these people talk a good, and on top of that, all were bankrupt, you have to remember. So I don't know what these people are talking about or why they're talking about it, but I know not one of them has bothered to tell the American people the truth.
Well, on a great many of those things, and I wonder whether you think that, you know, they're saying in the media that there's a fight, a discrepancy between Obama and the generals about whether they're going to send ground troops or not. It seems clear enough to me, like I was explaining just by thinking it out, that under their assumptions of what must be done here, eventually they will be sent in the Army of the Marines, probably sooner than later. But I wonder if you think Obama is being dishonest or if he really thinks he can do, you know, a kind of Northwestern tribal territory style drone war against, as you said, a state, a new kind of proto state.
He may well think that, Scott, because he was educated in the Ivy League, and he clearly doesn't understand the power of religion in today's world. He's like Christopher Hitchens in that regard. Hitchens was a very brilliant man, but he was stupid in terms of world affairs because he could not get his arms around the idea that religion plays an extraordinarily strong role in every place but England and the United States for the most part, and most of Western Europe. And I think Obama's the same way. He said something about after the first American was decapitated, he said, well, the world in the 21st century will not put up with this. And it's like somehow human nature has changed because he's in the world and he's ruling us. Mm-hmm. Human nature is always the same. People are going to kill each other, and the most barbarous methods that they find are useful.
Right. Yeah, you know, even Francis Fukuyama in The End of History, where he says, you know, more or less free markets and more or less democracy are the final form of human sovereignty, et cetera, et cetera. He still said, you know, so that basically excludes fascism and communism from ever being able to work, and no one's going to ever believe in them again as really being able to work. But he did not at all discount the power of ethnic and tribal and religious identity and nationalism and every
Scott.
Other kind of other, you know, right-wing flavor. He just said that no matter how right-wing you are, you're still going to have to let people, you know, let there be prices on the market, basically, you know.
Well, you know, you go back to Sam Huntington's book, and the older that book gets, the more correct it is. there is a clash of civilizations, but what he didn't expect was it would be waged by the American and British and European administrations against the Muslim world. They're not trying to install Sharia here. They're not trying to keep our women from going to university. We're trying to destroy their faith. We're trying to impose secularism on them, or worse, heresy in the Shias of Iraq. And this is not a complicated problem, Scott. It is an easy problem to understand if you're willing to kind of abandon the lousy education you had, not you, but I mean generally our leadership, accept the world as it is.
Yeah, no, you're right. I definitely think you're right. And, you know, it's funny because I'm a libertarian and a pretty evangelical one at that, and I sure believe that, you know, individual human rights to me, you know, are the top of my priorities and for all people in the world. And I would like very much to kind of sell the ideas of libertarianism on the market to the world, like Harry Brown and his great Statue of Liberty speech. If he had been the president, 9/11 wouldn't have happened because he would have ended all the interventionism. And then he would have just given speeches beating people over the head about liberty all the time and how wonderful it is. And if you want to change the world and make the world a more Declaration of Independence kind of a place, that's the way you do it. You do it how Ron Paul would do it. He'd explain it to you and recommend, like, you know, which Hayek should you read first and that kind of thing. And instead, we got George W. Bush and the rest of them since just going, yeah, I'll show you freedom. It's a daisy cutter in your neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, Ron Paul, of course, is an echo and an eloquent one of Washington, of John Adams, of Alexander Hamilton. Absolutely the case that we were going to be the best we could be at home. And if that is if that serves as an educational tool for the rest of the world and something they want to follow, fine. If not, also fine. You know, look at Europe hasn't been closer to war in 60 years than it is now. Why? Because we and the Europeans intervened to overthrow that government in Kiev.
Right.
If you can't see the problem with intervention, you're bordering on a fascist. And I think Obama's administration has strong fascist influences in it.
Yeah, sure, they all do. I mean, and also, you know, like, I want to argue with you every time, but then I think, no, you're right. I mean, hell, your job was telling these people what the truth is and looking at the glaze in their eyes when you told them. That's your job at the CIA. These people, as you keep explaining it, they just don't understand. Hillary Clinton can sit here and be mad at Obama publicly for not backing the rebels in Syria enough. John McCain was saying to Chuck Hagel on TV yesterday or the day before yesterday, well, what if Assad attacks the rebels? You're still not going to protect them from him? And it's like, dude, are you kidding me? These people, they really don't understand, do they?
That they don't.
You really are on all sides of a sectarian civil war here, Mr. McCain, and you're doing the wrong thing here, pal.
You know, I used to think that there was only two choices, Scott. They either didn't understand it, or they understood it and they're lying because they don't want to upset the apple cart, of multiculturalism, the apple cart of open borders, the apple cart of all civilizations and people are the same. Because they're going to have to, at some point, if America is to survive, if America is not to fight a war in North America against these people, someone's going to have to stand up and say, listen, what we're facing is a religious war against 1.3 or 4 billion people. Chop out the Shia and you have 1.2 billion Sunnis. What do you want to do? You want to keep pursuing the policies that make them attack you? Or would you like to live here comfortably in North America as we have for a long time? And if they want to be libertarians or Democrats or whatever they want to be, let them be it. But we're not going to help them be it. Mm-hmm. But I can't see that happening with Mr. Paul or Dr. Paul out of the picture and his son really not seeming to know where he stands on most every issue. I don't know where it's going to come from.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm glad that you went back to that because I wanted to clarify something when you were saying earlier about Al-Qaeda being good Muslims for outside of the power of the state resorting to fighting an enemy that is attacking from without.
Obviously, you're an American and you're on America's side in this, but you're just, you know, dispassionate analysis, as you say. But you call them good Muslims in that sense. And I wonder whether, and, you know, honestly, I don't know enough about the what all the Quran says or what modern Sunni imams' consensus is on these questions exactly. But I assume that they don't countenance targeting innocent civilians in order to score political points.
Well, no, they probably don't, but they understand what war is about, Scott. You know, the idea that civilians, innocent people, don't get killed in wars is something, kind of a New Age thought. Has nothing to do with reality. It has nothing to do with war. It has nothing to do with history.
Well, it's the difference between targeting them or not, right? Kind of. I mean, that's certainly what the U.S. government says when it kills people, is that, well, we were shooting at this guy, and those guys shouldn't have been nearby. But
a war
that's
is never
going to
be a science, John. Yeah. Who firebombed Tokyo?
Oh yeah, Truman.
You know, the only mercy in war is a speedy conclusion. The first thing is, don't go to war unless it's a direct life and death interest. But if you have to go to war, then kill everybody you need to kill and get out of it. It's a mercy to them and it's a mercy to us.
Well, but
all the rest of the crap about just war. They ought to get all those just war philosophers, professors, teachers, pundits, and turn them over to the Khmer Rouge for about two months of re-education.
Actually, the Republicans do have connections right to the Khmer Rouge. That could be arranged.
But I just picked a group out of my hat, that's all.
No, it's a good one. Yeah, and one with, you know, friends in the Reagan administration. No, listen, though, but here's the thing, though, about that. Is, and like you say, and you've reiterated a few times, never mind the Shia for the sake of argument here. They're the minority and the outgroup among, and certainly not the enemy that we're addressing here anyway. But the reaction of Muslims from Morocco to the Philippines was they were horrified about September 11th. And they didn't think Osama was a hero and represented them. And they sure as hell didn't endorse his tactics of targeting and slaughtering civilians in our towers. And,
well, I would say about that, Scott, how do you know?
Well, you know, I read the Gallup poll did one hell of a great survey where they said they love America, they just hate our foreign policy, and they certainly don't support terrorism as defined as targeting civilians in order to create this kind of reaction, that kind of thing. And they studied, they didn't do phone calls, and they went on the ground from Morocco to the Philippines and all through Indonesia and everywhere else and talked to Muslims all over the world and found that, you know, more like the other part of what you say, that they just hate our foreign policy. Otherwise, we could be getting along just fine here. It's not so much a religious mandate as it's the same mandate that the Wolverines took in Red Dawn or any nationalist would take in fighting for his own home county in any war. You know,
well, what I would say is the intervention puts Islam into play, puts religion into play. I also have always suspected the Poles. Perhaps not as much as Indonesia and Malaysia, but the polls taken among Muslims in places like Egypt and Morocco and other places where the society is basically completely infiltrated by security officers and their agents, people don't want to be saying things that might bring them into jail. Like, yeah, we thought Osama's attack on New York City was a great thing. Very few people are going to say that and risk having Mubarak's security service come down on their heads at that point.
Sure.
But I would say the other thing about in comparison to those polls, Scott, is look at the growth in the movement. Geographically, manpower. The other thing I would say is the one thing that almost wrecked al-Qaeda in 2006 was Zarqawi cutting the heads off of people and televising it. There was an enormous revulsion in the Muslim world, and not just from the clerics that worked for King Abdullah or who worked for Mubarak, but from common people. Right now, today, that's entirely missing.
Yeah,
the clerics that work for...
It's gone on too long now, in other words.
I think the movement has done two things. First, it has spread. Three things. Second, the Muslim world is more and more motivated by our intervention in it. And third, they've been successful. They defeated when Osama talked about the Arabs following the strong horse, they just beat us in Iraq. They're beating us in Afghanistan, which I think at the end of the day is probably a more serious problem than Iraq is in terms of immediate. And if we go back into Iraq with any kind of ground troops, they'll beat us again there. These guys got rifles from the Korean War. How are they beating a superpower three times in 15 years?
Stupidity on this side, or at least...
Absolutely, sir. Not, absolutely.
And see, it's not just stupidity, because it's willful stupidity. I mean, the idea after September 11th, I don't know if I could prove this, but I certainly believe was go ahead and let Osama go, because we need that Goldstein, because there hardly was an Al-Qaeda at all. It was a few hundred guys. That was why, you know, if you want to be real cynical about it, well, I don't know. It's a hindsight thing. But the real Al-Qaeda movement, the new generation of Al-Qaeda, everything after September 11th came with the invasion and the destruction of the Iraqi government in 2003. Not
well, that's
before
exactly
that.
Correct. That's exactly correct, Scott. What it did was probably something that Obama or Osama could never have done by himself, yeah. And that's make the jihad self-motivating. It has not been affected negatively in the least by bin Laden being killed, perhaps emotionally among some people who miss him. But the movement itself is growing. Al-Qaeda is part of it, but it's no longer the vanguard. Yeah. It is part of the movement. It's an important part of the movement. But it is not what it was in 2005 and 6.
Yep. All right, I'm sorry that we got to stop this conversation. We could keep talking for a long, long time, but I know you got to go, and I sure as hell am late. So thank you very much for your time, Mike. I appreciate it.
Pleasure, Scott. Look forward to talking to you again.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Great times. All right, everybody, that is Michael Scheuer. He wrote the book, Osama Bin Laden. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to let you know Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day, is now available at your local bookstore and Amazon.com. Grab a cold cup of coffee and follow Tacoma, Washington Detective Rick Thompson as he investigates the mystery behind the mass murder of dozens of hot young strippers and roller derby girls all across the West, while he learns new things about the world and himself. Pizza Noir, Book 1 by Denver Day. Normal, as we knew it, is a thing of the past. Find it at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys. I'm Scott Horton, and sorry, I know it sounds terrible to you live listeners when I blow the brakes like that, but I just didn't want to interrupt Michael Scheuer. I kept interviewing him all the way up until just 1 minute ago or something. The archive of the full interview will be up at scotthorton.org/interviews later on. And if any of you guys are writers, there are news stories and some of the things that he said, I think, about this current war. You might want to go back and take a look. Our next guest on the show today is our friend James Bamford, and he wrote the book on the NSA, The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, A Pretext for War, and The Shadow Factory. And A Pretext for War talks about other things besides the NSA, but there's some NSA stuff in there too. And also, it's a really great book about all kinds of stuff and how the neocons light us into war and everything. It's awesome. And did I mention The Shadow Factory? And he's got this one here at the New York Times, Israel's NSA Scandal. And just a couple of months back, he had Edward Snowden, The Untold Story, in-depth interview and study of Snowden and his situation and his revelations for Wired magazine, which is all available at wired.com. Welcome back to the show, Jim. How are you doing?
Yeah, great, Scott. Thanks.
Good. Very happy to have you here. And I'm reminded, if I ever knew, I must have forgotten that you actually started off on this course. I must have read this in one of your books at some point, that you actually started off on this course because you were a whistleblower yourself in the U.S. Navy. Can you tell us about that real quick?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I wrote a little bit about that in my Wired article about what I met with Snowden. What happened was I was in the Navy for 3 years during the Vietnam War, and I was assigned to a unit in Hawaii that was the Navy's equivalent of the NSA, the Navy's NSA branch, basically. So like Snowden, I was in the NSA in Hawaii, and most of what I learned there was just had to do with the Vietnam War and so forth. But then when I came back and I was in law school, I was in the reserves, Navy reserves, and then I was sent on a two-week active duty to a listening post in Puerto Rico. And while in the listening post, one of the people there asked if I wanted to listen to one of the conversations they were hearing on the earphones, since I was just sort of wandering around as a 2 weeks active duty there. So I said, sure, but I didn't speak Spanish, which is mostly what they were targeting down there. But he said, don't worry, you know, I was speaking English. So I listened to it, and there were Americans speaking. I didn't really think much of it when I was down there. And then when I got back to law school, I started thinking about, don't you need a warrant for something like that? And I was a student prosecutor in my last year in law school. So we talked about getting warrants and so forth and probable cause and all that. So I thought it was very odd that they didn't have any kind of legal justification for eavesdropping on Americans. And around that time, the church committee was starting. So I let the church committee, I gave them a call and just happened to tell them that the, you know, what I was doing, what I heard down there. They were very surprised, and they sent a investigator down, and he discovered, you know, that what I was saying was true. And I ended up spending a number of days down in Washington testifying before the committee in executive session.
Wow, that's really something else. A big part of history there, a small footnote in a big part of history, Jim.
Well, that was one of the things that inspired me to write the first book about NSA, The Puzzle Pals. Was, you know, I thought if they were getting away with this, who knows what else they're getting away with, and nobody's ever heard of this agency, and somebody should look into it. So that's why I decided to, after I graduated from law school, to become a writer and start off with The Puzzle Pals.
Mm-hmm. And then... I guess lately I've been leaving this out of your bio because it's been a while, but you were a producer for ABC World News Tonight for a long time and got into journalism besides just the NSA books, too. You did a lot of other work. Should mention that from time to time. And you've written a lot of great articles for Rolling Stone, like The Man Who Sold the War and a lot of other things for Wired and other things. I like to mention all that stuff. It's good work. Please talk to us about Unit 8200 and these new refuseniks.
Well, Unit 8200 is something I've known about for a long time because it's the Israeli equivalent of NSA. It's been very secret. Very few people ever hear about it. It doesn't really get any attention. Just to back up a bit, I was in Moscow last summer, and Ed Snowden, when I was interviewing him, I spent 3 days with him. In Moscow, among the things he told me was that the NSA was passing to Unit 8200 unredacted intercepts that it was picking up in the U.S. And around the world. And so that was very shocking because even England, even friendly countries that are part of the Five Eyes agreement, don't get unredacted or intercepts where the names and personal information is deleted. So they were giving that to Israel, which was quite shocking. And then last week, it turned out that 43 veterans of Unit 8200, some of them still serving in the reserves, decided to basically walk out or quit. They said they weren't going to do this type of activity anymore because it was a violation of the rights of the Palestinians. They accused them of using intercepts that talked about sexual activity, things like that, and then using that as blackmail against the Palestinians, such as their sexual preferences if they happen to be gay, and then use that to blackmail them into becoming workers for Israel, you know, informants for Israel, which they thought was very disgusting, and they decided to quit. I've never seen an intelligence agency anywhere at any time where you have 43 people all of a sudden agree to basically stop and blow the whistle.
They
had 43
amazing
whistleblowers from Unit 8200, and they, like Snowden, they didn't hide their names. They all signed a letter to the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So it was quite extraordinary. And when you put those two facts together, the fact that the NSA is sending unredacted information from the United States, and that may include a lot of information from Palestinian Americans communicating to their relatives in Palestine or in Israel, and then having that all secretly turned over, names and data and everything else, to the Israelis, who then use it to blackmail and intimidate and coerce innocent Palestinians, then, certainly a scandal.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you know if any of the refuseniks have actually mentioned the NSA hall in doing this work, or just it's as simple as that? They're using everything that they've got, including, of course, what the NSA is turning over to them. That, as you said, would include even people in the United States, maybe.
Right. They didn't specifically mention NSA, but they didn't eliminate anything. They just said what they said was that there were virtually no controls on any of the information that they took in. There was no oversight, no controls. And the U.S. Back in 2009, in March of 2009, had an agreement with Israel where they would give them all this unredacted information. And the U.S. put a caveat in there saying that the Israelis should abide by U.S. Laws and so forth. But there was nothing in there to enforce it. It specifically said this is a non-binding agreement. And as the veterans of Unit 8200 indicated, there was no supervision of any of that. So there was no internal restriction saying, now this is American, don't use it. There weren't any restrictions whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. And then I'm trying to find, here it is, right here in your New York Times article, Jim. You use the phrase virtually all forms of communication. Am I understanding you right? You're saying the NSA, and you're referring back to this Guardian story and the Snowden documents,
right,
that you're telling me they're given the entire hall of their daily vacuuming up of every one and zero in the world. They're turning it over to the Israelis on a daily basis, and then separately, secondarily, it's on the Israelis to not look at what the congressmen are saying to their mistresses or the judges are saying to the defense contractors that pay them off or any of these kind of things? They're on their honor to
Palestinian Americans are saying to their relatives back in Palestine or Israel. So no, there are no restrictions. Veterans, the whistleblower said, plus the U.S. document itself said it will cover virtually all forms of communication, including but not limited to unevaluated and unminimized transcripts, GIFs, facsimiles, telex, voice, and digital network intelligence, metadata, and content. That's a big word for email.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, virtually everything, a fax, a telex, a telephone call, and it's talking about content and transcripts and so forth. So, and then it said the agency routinely sends this information, this unminimized data, to Israel. So, no, it's quite extraordinary because, you know, this is a foreign country, and these are private communications by innocent Americans.
I'm more concerned about the guilty ones, Jim. Like you're saying about these poor Palestinians, people with power in America being compromised because it's not just Tom, Dick, and Harry and your local Palestinian neighbors who are having their information turned over, but this wouldn't exclude Congress. It wouldn't exclude high-level officials of the executive branch. It wouldn't exclude federal judges, would it? This would include everything on them, too.
There was absolutely nothing in there saying any kind of exclusion. It was everything. I mean, there was no, the words were, all forms of communications unevaluated, unminimized, the transcripts and so forth. So, no, there wasn't any restrictions on what kind of information would be sent. So, yeah, it could be anything. And that's very dangerous when you allow a foreign country complete access to private U.S. communication.
Mm-hmm. I think this article, this op-ed piece of yours in the New York Times may have been the New York Times' first mention of this story. They certainly did not cover it when it originally came out, as they usually do with new Snowden stories that appear in other places. You know, they'll have a New York Times write-up that says the Washington Post said today kind of thing, but they sure didn't mention this one until now, it looks like. So, or I don't think they did anyway. I know they didn't at the very beginning, so... that's kind of part of our problem is that, you know, you've been reporting about the NSA and different aspects of their relationship with the Israeli government in pretty scandalous terms, I think, for, 7 years now. And that never made the New York Times either. So now here we are 7 years later, and we see that the same kinds of things are still going on.
Well, yeah, and when the New York Times decided not to do a story based on that, when some of these details came out originally in the Guardian, not the whistleblower aspects of it, but the fact that the NSA was sharing the information with Israel. The later on, a couple of days later, I think it was the ombudsman for the New York Times said that was a mistake; they shouldn't have done that. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to write this, was because the it had been overlooked a great deal in the United States, and so I thought that this is a perfect opportunity to re-alert people to the fact that this is going on. And the peg, you know, the really interesting peg is the fact that you have 43 people from the Israeli NSA complaining about the immoral and improper use of this information.
Mm-hmm. All right, and now... can you remind us again about, is it Naras and Verint and these Israeli companies and their software, and what was the controversy back when your book came out, The Shadow Factory, in 2007?
Yeah, what I thought was really fascinating when I was writing my last book on NSA, The Shadow Factory, was when I was looking into these companies that that were given access to all this intelligence, or all this private communications in the U.S., a company such as Naras, for example, was actually formed by Israelis and largely formed in Israel, although they had an office in California. And what Naras did was sell to NSA all the equipment for deep packet inspection. In other words, the hardware and software that was used in the secret rooms, such as in San Francisco, to sift through all the incoming traffic and then look for whatever NSA puts on its watch list, names of people, email addresses, anything that they're looking for. So that's why I made a point of discussing it in my book, was because here you have a company that was largely formed by intelligence people from another country that was putting this equipment in a room that was analyzing and intercepting the communications of private Americans. And another company called Verint was very similar. They were being used by, I think it was by Verizon, where Naras was being used by AT&T, Verint was being used by Verizon. And at one point in Australia, who had also bought some of this Verint equipment, mm-hmm. and software, the Australian government discovered that some of that information was being sent out from its repositories in Australia to a foreign country, which I just assume would be Israel, and they threatened to cancel the suit that came from a confidential document I got from the Australian government. And so it shows that not only are these companies allowed to get access to all this data, there's been instances where they've exfiltrated this data to someplace else, to another foreign country.
Mm.
And, you know, it's funny now with these Snowden documents, I guess we could see how the argument took place in the office that, well, so what? We already have a memorandum of understanding with the Israelis that they can have everything anyway. So if they got the best software for getting everything, we might as well let them. Who cares if they have a back door? We're letting them in the front door. It's wide open.
Yeah, exactly. So who knows what the discussions were, but certainly it didn't sound like there was anybody that was raising any major objection to the NSA, because they gave them full access, and that's more access than they even give to their Five Eyes partners.
Oh, and you know what I've been meaning to ask you, Jim, is a discrepancy in my understanding about just how much audio they are getting. Do they have their computers, you know, quote-unquote, listening to for keywords? How much of it are they saving? I don't remember all my footnotes anymore. I used to be really good at this, but somewhere it stuck in my head that they intercept 80-something percent of all landline calls and 100% of all mobile calls. And they're working on making it more. And I thought maybe I had learned that from you, either from your book or from your interview with William Binney, or I'm not sure. But then it seems like that is decidedly not part of the Snowden revelations, that they're actually listening to all of us. They say, no, 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 it's just the metadata, quote unquote, just. And we all know metadata accounts for a lot. But the point being, you know, are they listening to us or are they not listening to us, Jim?
Well, my understanding is that first of all, they, with regard to metadata, they, ever since 9/11, they've been collecting all the metadata. That means all the metadata for telephone calls, for example. So, anytime somebody calls somebody, anytime you receive a call or make a call, there's a record of that. Anytime, you know, anybody old enough to pick up a telephone is making a call in the last 7 years. Or the last decade or so, then NSA has a record of that. They keep records of that, and that's what some of the controversy is over now, is whether to stop that. And up until just a few years ago, they used to do the same thing for all the metadata regarding email. So email, anytime anybody sent or received an email, there'd be a record of that. And as far as I know, none of that has ever been destroyed or anything. So there's probably a decade's worth of everybody's email being held by NSA. In terms of content, that's different. There's just not enough people to listen to all the conversations. So as far as I know, they don't. But what they're doing now, though, with this new facility at Bluffdale is – part of what Bluffdale will be, this is the big NSA million-square-foot, $2 billion sort of external hard drive, big storage center for NSA in Utah. Part of that will be used as what they sort of call a buffer memory. In other words, information will be put in there, including information to and from Americans. And then that information will remain in there for about a month or so, until more information comes in and, you know, fills it up and pushes the other information out. So it'll be kept in there. And then if they want to look through that, they have whatever that time period would be, say a month or whatever, so look through all the content if they want.
You're talking audio files, in other words. Audio recordings.
As far as I know, audio and email. Audio is much more difficult because it's eats up much more bandwidth and all that stuff. But as far as I know, it's kind of like everything. Well, at least I know it's the email. I'm not sure of the voice content, but it's certainly the metadata. Mm-hmm. And then whoever is actually targeted, however, in that NARS equipment or anywhere else that NSA is targeting the incoming communications or outgoing communications, mm-hmm. then that voice data would definitely be captured, because the people were on that list. And last time I heard, the watch list was like a million names or whatever. So it's somewhat complex in terms of what's kept and what's listened to and all that. And then the other part of Bluffdale will store things forever, for example. So there's a variety of ways they have of capturing, eavesdropping, and storing information. Mm-hmm.
But now on the question of the computers, and I'm sorry because I used the term listening way too loosely there. What I meant was the computers filtering for keywords. Like what movie, The Bourne Identity or whatever, where the reporter says the code word Blackbriar on the phone, and
right.
the computer is listening for the keywords, and if the computer notices the keyword, then it calls the attention to Jones to come over and look at this. But so on that question,
and, right.
I'm sorry, and so, but then on the 80-20, on that question, I think the 80-20 was on how much audio they're actually filtering for keywords. It was 80% of landlines and 100% of mobile traffic. Am I just blowing smoke with that? Do you not remember that or where that came from? Do you know?
I'm not sure. It's in terms of filtering, it's virtually everything coming in or going out of the country because that's where they have the filtering equipment.
So the audio is being scanned. Virtually all the audio is being scanned for flagging later if necessary kind of thing.
Well, audio is different. I don't think they have the capability to filter all the content of audio as it's going through. They don't have that voice recognition capability that could do everything coming in. What they do is they look for the metadata, the telephone metadata, and they pick that up and then they keep it. The problem with telephone voice communications is that it you got the problem of accents and all that. It's much easier with digital communications because although you may say house and have an accent or use a foreign language or whatever, and it's difficult for the computer to pick up and understand, it's not a problem for a piece of written communications because you're going to spell house just the same way everybody else spells house.
Sure.
So if you have a computer that can scan, do deep packet inspection, it's mostly on the digital data, email, and that kind of thing. So
right.
I mean, I'm always on the outside looking in.
Sure.
So,
sure.
You know, again, I'm giving this based on what I've been able to put together, but it is extremely complex in terms of what they're doing, and it changes constantly, so
right.
you just never know. But that's the problem. The problem is that there's very little regulation of NSA, and what regulation there is classified, so nobody knows what it is that they do.
Right. All right, well, with that, I better let you go. I've kept you over time, but thank you so much for your time. It's great to talk to you again, Jim.
Great. Thanks for having me on your show. It's a great show. Thanks a lot, Scott.
Appreciate
Bye-bye.
It. All right, y'all, that is James Bamford. He wrote The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, A Pretext for War, and The Shadow Factory about the NSA. He's got a new in-depth, gigantic, I don't know, 10,000-word essay about his time in Russia with Edward Snowden, and he's got a brand-new article in the New York Times. It's called Israel's NSA Scandal, and it's about these refuseniks. And then taking the opportunity to bring up again this article that ran in The Guardian back last September 11th, in fact. NSA shares raw intelligence, including Americans' data, with Israel. And with that, I have proven that I am absolutely the worst at sticking to the hard break schedule for this radio show. But god dang it, a lot of people listen to the archives later anyway, and I just can't help but want to keep asking my questions. Now I'm trying to call Darge Mail, and it's busy. I don't think I've ever gotten a busy from Skype before. It doesn't seem to be busy now. It's ringing, so let's see. Nope. Well, sakes alive. All right, I'm typing to Dar. Line busy? What the hell? Skype? You know, Skype is more trouble than it's worth. You know, Tom Woods is going to interview me today. Isn't that cool? And Tom Woods, I asked his guy that helps set up his appointments and stuff. I says to him, I says, you ever use Skype? And he says, used to, but Tom decided, forget it. Let's just do landline only. And I says to him, I understand. Skype is so ridiculous, man. And the sound quality is so much better. You might think that, you know, my guest in Iraq is in the room with me. And that's a good way to do radio, man. I have to concede that. But this is why it took me years to even incorporate Skype into the show. I mean, first of all, it's just a pain in the ass audio-wise with the minus signal and everything else. You understand what I mean? But anyway, I'm just killing time while I keep trying to call him back over and over again. And it's just not working, guys. It's just not working. I think Darge Mail might not be on the show today. Yeah, man. So, you know, I didn't ask Scheuer about the Lou Dobbs interview and what he said about how it's a bad idea to help Assad. I guess that was more or less covered in other context there. Anyway, Michael Scheuer, he's an interesting case, man. He says things like, when you have an enemy, you go in there and kill him. Was it during the break, or did you guys hear the part where he was saying it's some kind of ridiculous New Age fantasy that you could have any kind of just war? Well, okay, but so that's why to oppose war all the time, because killing civilians is wrong. Instead, he has the attitude that, like, killing civilians happens in war. He's even, in a way, saying it doesn't really, you know, reflect that bad necessarily on Al-Qaeda that they target civilians from the point of view of those they are defending. Because, hey, that's what happens. Lord knows, hell, he went back to World War II. Who firebombed Tokyo? Hey, who killed a million Iraqis? Who fought a giant civil war to give Baghdad to the Shia Arabs for the first time ever? What the hell's that about? And then I was saying, well, but specifically targeting civilians, though. And he's like, meh, war kills civilians. And he wins that argument, even though, and he's willing to state it in the most controversial way from the point of view of the other side. That's just the cost of doing business in a war. And he says the same thing about what our side should do to their side. But then he says, but don't bother. You know, since you're not going to go ahead and kill them all, you shouldn't kill anyone. You should just knock it off. And then he turns into a total peacenik. And he just says, leave the freaking Middle East alone. For God's sake, he said, build the pipeline, meaning the Keystone, from Canada to the Gulf. Why can't they just build a refinery in Canada? What is the big deal? I don't understand. I don't care either. But he said, build the damn pipeline and then cut off all ties with Saudi Arabia and then let them fight. Just stay the hell out of it, 100%. And I sure agree about that. In fact, I guess I have to admit that the fact that he is such a right-wing nationalist warmonger type who doesn't even really qualify by saying, if they insist on fighting, I guess we gotta let them. He says, let them kill each other. You know, it makes his argument stronger, because that's what Americans think, really. So, you know, to him, it's not even sad. Never mind, is it a question of whether we should intervene? Psh, who cares? And in fact, that's a much more conventional conservative view, if it could be applied in a conservative, non-interventionist kind of way. Why must we intervene? And I think especially it's important when here's a guy who is as paranoid as anyone is about these guys want to target and kill Americans. And he's been screaming about this since he still worked in the government. They let him create his own little bin Laden unit, which they actually, like, put at some other campus somewhere, right? So they didn't want to hear from him. He's been screaming about this since, you know, I was still in high school. Hey, somebody's got to kill these guys. And now his attitude is just stop. Even when Baghdadi, who is Osama reincarnate, only as he was saying, even better, he has real advanced degrees in Islamic studies that Osama could only pretend to have. And now he's declaring himself the caliph, which doesn't just mean the leader of the state around here, but it means the self-appointed leader of all Muslims which, if you're a Shia, he's coming for you. If you're a Sunni, then you count as a Muslim to him, and you must bow down. And they cut all their people's heads off, and their enemies machine gun civilians to death and crucify them, and they're savages. And here's Scheuer, who can just as easily, depending on how you come at him with the question, could say, nuke them all, says, just let it be. Just let it be. And he wasn't even really making, you know, my kind of utilitarian case that really is the best utilitarian war strategy here anyway. They're surrounded by enemies, but enemies who can only make things worse if they actually cross the lines and really encroach into this Sunni territory. So just let them sit contained, landlocked, surrounded by enemies, and sitting atop a tribal system that they're basically alien to. It's not really the tribal system that is ISIS. It's the tribal system that allied with ISIS. And it's the Baathists, too. The former military commanders of the Baath Party have allied with it, too. Mitchell Prothero talked about that. The reason that they are militarily successful in a lot of ways and times and places is because they have real military professionals running things. And the jihadists, in this case, are smart and, whatever the right word for it is that I can't think of enough to go ahead and concede that, okay, you guys are the military experts, you guys do the military expert stuff, rather than hogging all the decisions for themselves, is what I'm trying to say, you know? They have enough humility, that's the word I'm looking for. They had enough humility to say, all right, Baathist generals, you guys are generals. You run the war, we'll tell you, you know, when and where to run it. You decide how. That kind of deal. Like Obama and the Pentagon. Anyway. Scheuer was not predicting the best situation if we just piss off. Sorry, I was off on a tangent about the Baathists. The point was, ISIS is really not the indigenous government of Sunnistan. They have grafted themselves on top, and it's just a matter of time before the locals kick them out if America wouldn't intervene. Because no one else can really cross the lines without American help anyway. They're not even going to try. So, but Scheuer's saying, you know what, even if it's just worse and worse and bad and whatever, it's crazy to just turn them against us. I got the idea that, and he said, too, he said it better than Matthew Ho, even. Matthew Ho said the beheadings are bait. Scheuer said those beheadings, they're just putting a worm on a hook. They need us. That's the quote that somebody needs to go back and write down about Michael Scheuer saying that the Islamic State, not just they want us to invade, they need us to invade for their legitimacy. Because war is the health of the state. Because that's their excuse for being the government of Sunnistan, of Bin Laden-stan. You need us to protect you from America and their Iranian Shiite allies, the ISIS is saying to the Sunni majority populations of Mosul, Fallujah, Tikrit, Bakuba, etc. I don't know them all. But here, Michael Scheuer, as paranoid about Bin Ladenites as any man in North America, and he's saying, just stop. Just stop. You can't fix it. You can't do it right just once and clean up the mess. Just stop. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, so wrapping up the show here today. Boy, I should have remembered to turn the fan on during the break in here. Boy. So today's the day that Scotland votes on their referendum on whether to secede from the United Kingdom. Wow. I'm rooting for the secessionists. Now I'm a Texan. It ain't really my thing. Antiwar.com does not have an official position, but yes, I want there to be no such thing as the United Kingdom anymore. I think that'll be hilarious. You know, back in history at the turn of the century, back when there's still such a thing as the United Kingdom, America invaded Iraq four times over again. Anyway, yeah, I just think that'd be great. Wouldn't that be great? And, yeah, there's all kinds of secessionist movements all over the world right now, mostly because of economic problems caused by Alan Greenspan and George W. Bush and their conspiracy to inflate a global bubble in financial instruments pretending to represent housing debt in America. And the rest of the entire boom and bust of the Bush Jr. years. But anyway, so yeah. Cool. I hope they win. They're 5 hours ahead of us over there. So what the hell, man? Does anybody have results yet? I'm putting Scotland in the Google News, dude. What are the projections over there in Scotland? Give me some news. I don't think they're saying yet. Doesn't look like. Somebody in the chat room, let me know if you know. Oh, it won't be announced till tomorrow, says chat room guy. Tomorrow morning, they'll say. Okay. Yeah, I'm pro-secession for sure. Hey, here's an article by Rothbard I haven't read yet, but I'll tell you about it. It's called, Is the UK a Nation by Consent? It's by Murray Rothbard, and he wrote this back when? I have no idea. But here it is at Mises.org. Is the UK a Nation by Consent? By Murray Rothbard. I bet you'll learn interesting stuff and probably laugh at a couple of things that Rothbard writes because he's funny. Okay. In other news, they're still fighting over the torture report, and I can't get rid of this tab because I keep forgetting to talk about it. And now I'm finally going to get rid of this tab because I'm going to talk about it. New sparks fly between the CIA and the Senate Intelligence Committee. Tensions between, and this is old as hell, this is from September the 12th. Tensions between the CIA and its congressional overseers erupted anew this week when CIA Director John Brennan refused to tell lawmakers who authorized intrusions into computers used by the Senate Intelligence Committee staff to compile a damning report on the spy agency's torture program. The confrontation, which took place during a closed-door meeting on Tuesday, came as the sides continue to spar over the report's public release, providing further proof of the unprecedented deterioration in relations between the CIA and Capitol Hill. After the meeting, several senators were so incensed at Brennan, they confirmed the row. The row, that's what the British call it. It's not a row unless we're British, and we're not. And in fact, after tomorrow, there'll be no such thing as the British anymore anyway. They'll just be the English again. Ha! Well, I mean, I guess Northern Ireland and Wales count, but do they really? Do they really, Marge? Huh? They confirmed the controversy and all but accused the nation's top spy of defying Congress. I'm concerned there's disrespect towards the Congress, said Carl Levin. I think it's arrogant and unacceptable. I continue to be incredibly frustrated with this disorder, said Senator Martin Heinrich. He does not respect the role of the committee in providing... Let me tell you something about how understated this is. This guy, Brennan, is in contempt of Congress. Only they don't have the stones, I guess, to make him literally in contempt of Congress. But you want to argue about the president being a co-equal branch? Well, the president can't fire Congress, and he can't even arrest him, but they can impeach and remove him. But his subordinates, like the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, they have no standing whatsoever in a constitutional republic to talk back to these senators whatsoever, to refuse to answer the Senate Intelligence Committee about which CIA employees gave the illegal order for them to spy
on the Senate Intelligence Committee staff under the pretext that they had a report. They had found an internal CIA report that the CIA had apparently accidentally given them, or at least had second thoughts about, that confirmed that all their worst accusations were right and that all the CIA's denials were lies. And then he thinks he's going to tell Feinstein no. At one point, a person familiar with the meeting, Brennan, raised his voice at Feinstein. And listen, this is the only time you'll ever hear me taking the side of Dianne Feinstein, but it's not about that at all. It's about any chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee saying, heel, to the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Their only job is to heel. That's it. That is it. He raised his voice at her. She should have slapped his face with her open hand and said, get down on your knees, you dog. Are you kidding me? In America, in the United States of America, the oldest democracy in the world, the director of the CIA talked back to the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee like he is at least her equal, or maybe more than her equal. In the, you know, real human dimension where I'm from, this is an absolute constitutional crisis. This man has been drummed out of office months ago. This is absolutely insane that this is happening. Whether they're fighting about a torture report that he's guilty of conspiracy in the torture himself, of course, Brennan, from back when he worked for George Bush. But whether it's about a torture report or anything else, just this kind of pushback from a subordinate in the executive branch like this, against the chair, especially, of the Senate Intelligence Committee like this. It's just protocol. It's just tradition, guys. There is no law. There's the only thing that keeps the Pentagon from invading the White House is just that, well, you know, we don't believe in that. We don't do business like that around here, guys, kind of thing. That's basically it. Just tradition. If the head of the CIA wants to murder the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee and hide her body in, I don't know, outer space or wherever he wants, the bottom of the Marianas Trench, I guess he can do that. He can do that. May he do that? You know, can you give up your republic, embrace empire, and then keep living like you have the form even of that old constitutional system? Or maybe from now on, the Senate Intelligence Committee will just report to the CIA. Is that how it works? That's amazing to me. And, you know, I guess there's been enough journalism about this for years to have real reason to believe that Feinstein thinks that it's important that people find out as much as they can under Washington rules about this torture report. And that, you know, she really, you know, I don't know what all she knew about it when and how good she's ever been on every aspect of it. She may have known it was happening and failed to stop it. I don't know. But she's been pretty damn good about investigating it and pretty damn good about pushing back against the CIA for their attempts to censor what she's doing, you know, what her committee staff has found out. But whatever, whether it's Feinstein, who is absolutely horrible on every other thing that there is to be horrible on, or whether it's anyone else, it's just, the separations of powers, the balance of power in Washington, D.C. is just not supposed to work like this. You know, this is one of those, who in the hell do you think you are situations. You're just the help here, Brennan. But no, he's the one who wears the pants, and Dianne Feinstein, I guess, is going to go cook him dinner now. And we'll read a bunch of blank pages when the redacted, declassified summary of the report is released. God. All right. Hey, thanks for listening to the show, guys. I appreciate it. Sorry I didn't have Dar. We'll see if we can get him on tomorrow. Marjorie Cohen tomorrow, too. See ya.